Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Dr. Mark Klein, the dynamic author of Franklin Rock. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We've had a truly gorgeous week of weather here in Tucson, Arizona, in the foothills and mountains of the verdant Sonoran Desert. Just spring. And that means it must be time for an annual rite of spring, and one never more ardently desired than this year, the return of spring training baseball. Yes, it may be midwinter for people in most northern hemisphere climates. It's true that lots of folks in Texas still don't have running water after their climate and governmental disaster. But it's definitely the beginning of springtime for us here in the Southwest and in Florida, where baseball spring training games are starting, albeit with only about 20% of their seats filled, lots of masks and social distancing. Still, for nearly the first time since last spring training, people will actually be in the seats to watch. That means it's time, here on Two Jewish, for us to play our classic Welcome to the Coming Baseball Season, Mandy Patinkin's Yiddish version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Koyf mir den Nisslo von Cracker Jack Die Lef kein Mul von dort nicht a weg Ich seh gut, mut mut die Ballspieler Es passt nicht als nun verspielt Weil sie seh zwei, drei Spikes Neus bei der Baseballspiel
That was Nehmt mir oist zu dem Ballgame, as sung by Mandy Patinkin, Yiddish version of Take Me Out to the Ballgame. Just in case you don't know, that melody was written by Albert von Tilzer, a Jewish Tin Pan Alley top songwriter from Indiana, of all places, to words by Jack Norworth. When they wrote that song, neither of these two songwriters had ever been to a baseball game. That remained the case for both of them for many decades after crafting Take Me Out to the Ball Game. But their song certainly has made it to every game for the last, 80-some years or so. And as the vaccines are distributed and immunities grow, soon perhaps we'll be able to fill up, at least partially, those empty stadiums with actual humans instead of cardboard cutouts. It's also the end of rodeo weekend here in Tucson, Arizona, in the heart of the Wild West where I live. So we need some Western themes on Too Jewish this morning. You can't really understand what a big deal rodeo week is here in Tucson unless you live here or have lived here for at least a year or two or 20-some years like me. Now, mind you, like so many events, this year the great Fiesta de Vaqueros, the Tucson Rodeo, was canceled. So consider this a reminder of what we've missed and what we can expect to come back in the early spring of 2022. In Tucson, Rodeo Week consists of a big parade followed by, I know this will shock you, a rodeo. We let kids out of school for a couple of days to go to the parade, wear cowboy boots and hats, and generally pretend we still have a connection to the folks who rode horses and tamed the Wild West. When you live here in the heart of the West, not far from Tombstone in what was Apache country not much over a century ago, rodeo can still be a pretty big deal. Now, you might not immediately associate Jews and cowboys, but there were quite a number of Jews even in the Old West. The legendary O.K. Corral gunslinger and lawman Wyatt Earp's common law wife, well, his last one anyway, was a Jewish woman named Josephine Marcus. There were Jewish mayors, sheriffs, and outlaws, and there are photos of them wearing the appropriate linen dusters, cowboy boots, and gun belts, and holding rifles. Some of those Jewish cowboys were involved in notorious incidents, and if you aren't sure of that, go and visit Boot Hill's Jewish cemetery in Tombstone, where not a few of them are buried. And, of course, there were Jewish merchants, including some of my ancestors, the Reinhardts, who had stores in the Gold Rush area and the rich foothills of the country near Auburn, California. I think they sold dungarees there, perhaps the newly invented ones with rivets, designed by a German Jewish entrepreneur named Levi Strauss. Pretty sure some people still wear that brand. And so, in honor of all those Jewish cowboys, merchants, and characters, here's a less than perfectly accurate musical version of another one of those legendary Jewish characters of the Old West. Long before saddles blazed across the West, there was the Ballad of Irving.
He was short and fat and rode out of the West with a Mogan David on his silver vest. He was mean and nasty right clear through, which was kind of weird because he was yellow too. They called him Irving. Big Irving. Big short Irving. Big short fat Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. He came from the old bar mitzvah spread with a 10-gallon yarmulke on his head. He always followed his mother's wishes. Even on the range, he used two sets of dishes. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big sissy Irving. 142nd fastest gun in the West.
Irving.
141 could draw faster than he, but Irving was looking for 143. Walked into Saul's saloon like a man insane and ordered 3 fingers of 2 cents plain. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big sport Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. The James boys was coming on a train at first sun, and the town said, Irving, we need your gun. Well, that train pulled in at the break of dawn. Irving's gun was there, but Irving was gone. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big help Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West.
Irving.
Well, finally, Irving got 3 slugs in the belly. It was right outside the Frontier Deli. He was sitting there twirling his gun around, and Butterfingers Irving gunned himself down. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big dum-dum Irving. Big dum-dum dead Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West.
Really?
That was the Ballad of Irving from a long time recording called You Don't Have to Be Jewish. Or it might have been When You're in Love, the Whole World is Jewish, or something like that. Anyway, well, the Ballad of Irving redefines the word classic, I think, by itself, about being Jewish in the Wild West. You know, my fiancée Sophie found a book in our Jewish library at our congregation, Beit Simcha, about Jews among the Indians by somebody named M. L. Marx, which my dad says is an excellent book, and I agree. It testifies to the experiences of a variety of Jewish peddlers and merchants who traded with, lived among, and befriended Native American tribes in the West, learning their languages and respecting their customs. It even includes a section on the famous painter and early photographer Solomon Nunez Carvalho. Some of the stories are remarkable, and the mutual respect between the Indians, the Native Americans, and the members of quite a different tribe, Jewish adventurers in the West, is evident. So, happy end of virtual rodeo week here in Tucson. May it return next year with redoubled energy and joy. When we come back on Two Jewish in a Moment, our guest, Dr. Mark Klein, will help us travel back on the remarkable journey of the protagonist of his new book, Franklin Rock. It's a good book. Meet him. We'll return in a moment here on Two Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a Jewish synagogue in the northwest of Tucson and the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter and now spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, life cycle ceremonies, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in its own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. During these waning days of coronavirus, Taurus, a small group joins us in person Friday night or Saturday morning. Email me to rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Beitsimcha Tucson.org, or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday, Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, Beitsimcha Tucson. We'll hold our services with full music by virtual experience weekly, as well as in-person, masked, and careful attendees. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom. You can access those by clicking on the website or emailing us at beitsimchatucson.org. Many of those classes, as well as our wonderful religious school, bar mitzvah, and so on, are available in blended formats as well, some people live and some on Zoom. Passover is coming up, Pesach, and you have the chance to celebrate a part together by coming to the Rabbi's Seder table, mine, at least virtually. Go to beitsimchatucson.org for more information coming soon. In fact, for information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of adult education academy courses, and of course Seder, all available on Zoom. Of course, all of our services on Facebook Live. Go to beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, beitsimchatucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish congregation and Jewish community in the Northwest and all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Dr. Mark Klein is the author of the new book, Franklin Rock, a delightful tale about, well, time travel, among many other things. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning, Rabbi. Thank you for inviting me.
So the first question is, you're a physician. You didn't have enough to do. You had to write a book?
Well, you know, it's funny you should ask. I get that question a lot. This is actually my third book. My first two were nonfiction books. This is my first novel. And the first two I actually wrote at the end of a day's work. I was younger then. This one, I wrote the majority of it actually during COVID, when our practice was in many ways almost completely shut down for a period. It's a book I had started long ago, but finally had no excuse not to really sit down and tackle the majority of it, which is what I did. So the answer to your question is I have plenty to do, but there's always more to do.
The idea of time travel, boy, it seems like every TV show now has time travel in it. But you treat it in a really interesting way. Tell us a little bit about that.
No, this is not a time travel book like a book like Jack Finney's book, Time and Again, or The Time Traveler's Wife. This is not a time travel book. Franklin Rock, who is the protagonist and for whom the book is named, uses time travel as a vehicle. And most of the time, his trips are short, and they're designed to where he learns something, he uncovers something. Each episode of time travel has a purpose to it. And again, they're short. Most of the time, he's not planning to travel back to go watch the dinosaurs. I mean, it's not like that kind of book. So time travel is more a vehicle for him to learn his mission, what he's supposed to do. And so I don't call it a time travel book. It just has that little nuance to help him accomplish what he needs to do.
You know, it reminds me of, Siddhartha, Jonathan Livingston Seagull. I don't know. A lot of different ideas come to mind about a story in which somebody grows in both spiritual and personal awareness. Did you think about it that way when you were writing it?
I did, and this is actually, in a way, this is the first time I'm going to say this because you're the first rabbi I've spoken to about my book and all the interviews I've done. This is the first purely Jewish one, and I can tell you there's a chapter in there called Pirkei Avot.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very Jewish book in the sense that Franklin is chosen. And for Jews, chosenness is not a gift, it's not a reward, it's not winning the lottery, it's responsibility. So Jews are chosen to repair the world, and in fact, Franklin Rock's mission is to fix the world. He learns along the way. The book starts out where he has an epiphany, really, more than an epiphany, it's a vision. He has a visual where he suddenly sees that his life is, he sees his whole life in front of him in one fell swoop, and realizes that he is to have a life, to go on a journey unlike any other, truly unique. He has no idea at the beginning, as a 20-year-old, what this means. And the first part of the book is learning, discovering what, in fact, his mission is and why he had this epiphany. But it's a very much Jewish book in the sense that his mission is to fix the world, and that he's chosen to do that.
Yeah, it's sort of a clear Tikkun Olam message, but it's not so clear for a while. We will talk much more with Mark Klein, the author of Franklin Rock, a really interesting new novel, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. Well over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, there's been so much coverage, I don't know how else to describe it, of the Shoah, of the Holocaust, partly the International Holocaust Remembrance Day in January, which has become a bigger and bigger thing in recent years, to be honest, but partly also a desire to interview the last of the survivors before they pass from the scene. There's been tremendous documentation on archives that were only opened in recent years or that were translated in recent years. Now there's some pushback on that. Let's explore that a little bit.
Right. Well, first of all, a couple of different things. Besides the general International Holocaust Remembrance Day, which occurred pretty recently, there was a Sephardic observation of a Remembrance Day for Sephardic victims of the Holocaust who were, frankly, often overlooked. And this was like a big international conference held virtually hosted in Washington, D.C., and they got a lot of speakers. And one of the most prominent of those speakers was a man from Thessaloniki named Albert Bourla. Now, for those of your listeners who don't know, he's the CEO of Pfizer.
As reported here on Too Jewish a couple weeks back.
And the driving force behind the development of the first vaccine that got approved in the U.S. for COVID. So this interview was the first time he actually talked publicly about his parents' story and how they survived the Holocaust. Because in Thessaloniki, the Jewish population was really decimated. They were all deported on trains to Auschwitz, and more than 90% of those who were deported were killed. Very few came back, right. And the ones who came back were by and large greeted with suspicion, not like wide open welcoming arms, but how did you survive when so many other people didn't? So
it reminds me of the synagogue in Thessaloniki, where they have the plaques from all of the synagogues that used to operate in Thessaloniki, right. And the one operating Shul.
Right. So this guy, Bourla, had never publicly spoken about his parents before, and he talked about them and his grandparents very lovingly and described the deportation of the Jews of Thessaloniki, which happened before he was born. He heard about this from his parents. But he also talked about his parents' values and how he has tried to live his life in such a way that his parents would always be proud of him. And the guy is so obviously a mensch. He didn't want to jump the line. He said when his age group is eligible, he'll get the shot.
Oh my.
He believes in the shot totally, but even though he's the CEO of Pfizer, he hasn't been vaccinated yet. And when he was talking about his parents with a very thick, almost caricature Greek accent, his eyes filled with tears. I mean, it was just beautiful to watch. And as one of my friends commented after seeing this YouTube clip, think how many of those 6 million people might have done other things to save the world if they had been allowed to live.
Yeah, stunning. I remember visiting the synagogue in Rhodes many years ago, and 95% of the Rhodes Jewish community was murdered by the Nazis. The devastation of the Sephardic world was extraordinarily terrible. Something to remember, something we forget. We'll maybe continue on this theme next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. In a Jewish insane asylum, one of the patients approaches the doctor in charge of the place and tells him that he's become Orthodox and wants to have his religious needs met so he can practice his newly redoubled faith. He tells the doctor he needs to have kosher food, a dedicated room to pray in like a synagogue, and somebody to take care of lights and fires and such on Shabbos. The doctor of the asylum agrees, it's a Jewish institution after all, and soon after they've provided the patient with kosher food, a synagogue, a prayer book, a tallis, and a non-Jewish person even to make sure he doesn't have to turn on or off lights on Shabbat. But the very next Saturday morning, the doctor catches the newly Orthodox patient standing outside smoking a cigarette. "What are you doing?" the doctor demands. "You can't light a fire on Shabbos if you're Orthodox." And the patient says, "But doctor, did you forget? I'm Meshuggah." You see, Meshuggah means you're nuts. Never mind. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and stay sane. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the traumatic portion of Ki Tisa, story of the golden calf. While Moses is on Mount Sinai receiving the Ten Commandments, the Israelites start to worry that he's not coming back. And so while God carves the words, "You shall have no other gods besides me, nor make any image of them," on a stone tablet, the faithless people below persuade Moses' brother Aaron to make them an idol of gold, a calf that they can now call their new god. Pleased with the result, they worship it and then throw a big party, a bacchanal, a carnival, Mardi Gras in the Sinai, Purim at the foot of, well, you got it. Coming down the mountain, Joshua and Moses hear noise from the camp below. Joshua is astonished, thinks it must be the sound of battle, but Moses knows what a party sounds like. And when he sees all the cavorting and the newly chosen people worshiping a golden idol, he throws down the sacred stone tablets of the commandments God has given him, shattering them. The music and dancing stop suddenly. It's a shocking scene. For the rabbis, this is one of the most dramatic and distressing portions in the whole Torah. The problem is acute. According to the text, our people witnessed the divine power of the 10 plagues, were personally saved at the shore of the Sea of Reeds by God, got the direct revelation at Sinai, in short, experienced God more directly than any group in history ever has, and almost immediately after turned around and rejected God in order to worship a cow made out of their own jewelry. In Rabbinic Midrash, this week's events are called the Maaseh HaEgel, the awful story of the calf. How can a people, given such a clear set of signs and wonders, including direct revelation and verbal command, only follow the true God for 40 days before pursuing such a ridiculous substitute? The answer lies in our own makeup. We enjoy spectacle, are impressed by it, awed by it even, but as soon as it's gone, the effects linger a very short time indeed, like the smoke following fireworks. What makes us tick as human beings, what really keeps us in line, is the very dailiness of regular rules and schedules, the kinds of laws and rituals that are very much a part of practical Judaism. We need both ritual and structure, and until these are provided in a coherent way, we tend to flounder, even disastrously so, as we did at the time of the golden calf. Without a way to connect to God regularly, without prayer services and a personal commitment to actually doing mitzvot every day, we quickly lose our ability to be holy. Instead, we chase gold, or idols, or both. We become obsessed with our own pursuits, chase our own idols of gold. We need more than grand ideas or sweeping spirituality. We need religion and a Jewish grounding in practice and experience, or we won't be able to remain ethical. Without that, we begin to worship golden calves of every kind. At the end of Ki Tisa, there's a denouement to this painful story of spiritual failure, providing a kind of limited redemption. Moses goes back up Mount Sinai and brings down another set of tablets, and then he asks God to reveal God's own essence to him. Moses doesn't get exactly what he wants, but he is provided with the privilege of experiencing God's passing presence. And then Moses, too, must continue to try to sense that presence every day thereafter. In other words, even Moses, the best of us, the person closest to God, continually must seek God's presence. How much more so is that true for the rest of us Jews today, we modern-day Israelites? In spite of our failures of faith and action, if we nonetheless continue to seek God, we too will be blessed with a touch of that sacred divine presence. We too may find holiness. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Dr. Mark Klein, will tell us why Franklin Rock, his first novel, has a lot to teach us about surviving the pandemic in Jewish ways and others, and a lot more. Find out all about it when we come back on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israel closed all of its Mediterranean beaches until further notice last week when an offshore oil spill deposited tons of tar across more than 100 miles of coastline, what officials are calling one of the country's worst ecological disasters in its history. Activists began reporting globs of black tar on Israel's coast last week after a heavy storm. The deposits have wreaked havoc on local wildlife, and the Israeli Agricultural Ministry determined that a dead young fin whale that washed up on a beach in southern Israel died from ingesting oil. Israel's Nature and Parks Authority has called the spill one of the most serious ecological disasters in the country's history. In 2014, a crude oil spill in the Arava Desert caused extensive damage to one of the country's delicate ecosystems. The Environmental Protection Ministry and activists estimate that at least 1,000 tons of tar Product of an oil spill from a ship in the Eastern Mediterranean earlier this month, have already washed up on shore. The ministry is trying to determine who's responsible. It declined to comment on details of the investigation. Yoav Ratner, coordinator of the ministry's oil spill contingency plan, said that there are still many unknowns about the extent of the ecological damage. It's difficult to say how long the cleanup will take. Thousands of volunteers took to the beaches to help clean up the tar. Several were hospitalized when they inhaled toxic fumes. The Israeli military also deployed thousands of soldiers to help in the operation. The Environmental Protection, Health, and Interior Ministries issued a joint statement warning the public not to visit the whole length of Israel's 120-mile Mediterranean coastline, cautioning that exposure to tar can be harmful to public health. No kidding. Environmental Protection Minister Gila Gamliel said that her department estimates the cleanup project will cost many millions of dollars. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu toured one of the country's tar-pocked beaches and praised the ministry's work. Representatives from a coalition of Israeli environmental groups said that the ministry is woefully underfunded and existing legislation does little to prevent or address environmental disasters. Arik Rosenblum, director of the Israeli environmental group Echo Ocean, said the Environmental Protection Ministry is fighting this situation and many other situations with its hands tied behind its back because of inadequate legislation. They cautioned that this disaster should be a wake-up call for the planned oil pipeline connecting the United Arab Emirates and Israeli oil facilities in Eilat, home to many endangered Red Sea coral reefs. In better news from Israel, initial reports testify that those who have received the two-shot Pfizer coronavirus vaccine, now most of the population of the country, seem to demonstrate that in addition to being essentially immune to severe COVID-19 infection, they are also much less likely to carry the virus to others who are not vaccinated. While health authorities remain cautious, this is certainly a very positive development in the fight against coronavirus. Israel is at the very forefront of vaccination in the whole world. At a potential return to more normal conditions in well-vaccinated parts of the world by late spring or early summer. Israel has also delivered thousands of coronavirus vaccines to the Palestinian Authority, as well as to the Czech Republic, Guatemala, and Honduras, joining a number of countries that are successfully vaccinating their own populations and are now assisting others with their surpluses. Israel has come under criticism for not extending its successful vaccine program to Palestinians in areas controlled by the Palestinian Authority. Israeli officials have said that under prior agreements and international law, it is under no obligation to do so and doesn't always have the ability even to do so. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken asked Israel last week to deliver vaccines to the Palestinians, and so they are now doing so. In light of the successful vaccination campaign in Israel and its being a global leader in vaccinating populations, Israel has received many requests from countries for assistance in supplying vaccines, said Prime Minister Netanyahu. Israel is not producing vaccines itself, of course, and has informed respondents that the quantities that were ordered by Israel are for the vaccination of its own population. No ability to render significant assistance is anticipated until the vaccines campaign in Israel will have ended, said Netanyahu. Nevertheless, over the past month, a limited quantities of unused vaccines were accumulated. Therefore, it's been decided to assist Palestinian Authority medical teams in several of the countries that contacted Israel with a certain number of vaccines. Netanyahu did not name the other countries. Reports are they include Honduras, Guatemala, and the Czech Republic. Honduras and Guatemala got a symbolic 5,000 doses each. Czech Republic said it received thousands of doses from Israel and many from other countries. All these countries have moved their embassies to Jerusalem, by the way, or said they will expand their diplomatic presence in Jerusalem. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Dr. Mark Klein is a physician and author. He's written a couple of nonfiction books. His first novel is called Franklin Rock. And as we said earlier in the show, it has a guy traveling to a variety of periods of time, including somewhere in which he recreates changes his own experience. I have to say the camp baseball game was one of my favorite parts of the book. Was there anything in your life that was kind of like that?
Of course. Who comes up with a camp baseball game out of nothing, right? So sure, summer camp, right? You know, for a certain group of people, and I'd say probably for Jewish people in general, or Jewish people who grew up in a certain milieu, at a certain period of time, but can relate to some of these things. And again, the travel to the baseball game and camp is an opportunity for Franklin to learn something about himself and, again, about his mission. It's all targeted to his mission, and his mission, again, is to fix the world. It's a very, very optimistic book, and I've been, you know, it's really a perfect time for a book like this to come out. There's so much negativity and sorrow, and, you know, I think I've written a book that was supposed to be fun, and I hope people will find it to be fun. I think it's an easy read and enjoyable. I describe the book as ice cream with vegetables in it. So it's a crazy analogy, because who would go into a Baskin-Robbins and order ice cream with vegetables in it? But the idea is that something sweet, something, a good story, everybody likes a good story. But in the middle of that story, when you're done with the book, you found out you ate a whole lot of vegetables, and you've gotten, you know, some nourishment, I hope, out of it. That was really the goal. You know, as a physician, I try and help. I do help, get to help somebody every day. It's a fantastic job. In fact, I'll tell you a story, Rabbi. I was talking to a minister a number of years ago, and he was asking me what I did, and I said, well, I'm a doctor. And he goes, do you like your job? I go, yeah, you know, it's great. I get to make a difference in somebody's life every day. And I looked at him, I said, actually, you have the same job. So, you know, in your situation, you know, rabbis, clergy, it's the same idea. You get a chance to help somebody in some way every day, and I'm sure you do. But, you know, what I wanted to do was say, okay, this is great. It's an addiction. Literally helping people, as you know, is an addiction.
It is, yeah.
How can I scale this a little bit more? And that's why I wrote Franklin Rock. My whole agenda is to just make this world a better place. Like, you know, I've reached a point in my life, I've been very fortunate. You know, now my focus is 100% on making the world a better place. So I figure, well, how can I do that? I don't really have a platform other than my day-to-day practice, which is not insignificant. And I do hope I have an impact on people every day, a positive impact. But writing a book, especially writing a novel, a story, people love stories, and to be able to communicate some of the themes that I think deliver a lot of optimism, a lot of hope, but in a very real sense, and just really to move the needle, to make the world a little better place. That it's as simple as that, actually.
So in creating the book, you get to meet a number of incredibly important people, and I guess if we had the ability to move back in time, even for short periods, it's probably something we'd want to do. You'd want to meet Albert Einstein or Martin Luther King Jr. How did you decide whom you were going to include in this?
Well, Albert Einstein was a no-brainer, because to me...
That's a funny thing to say about Albert Einstein, I have to say.
It's a funny thing. You know, I probably need to not say that again. Thank you for pointing that out. Okay, no more no-brainers for Albert Einstein.
For a genius, a Jewish genius, you shouldn't say no-brainer.
I shouldn't say that. No, but the point is, you know, who else is it, would you, you know, as a Jew, who else would you rather me? I mean, well, not would you rather me, but Abraham, you know, go on. Depends how far back you want to go.
It's pretty good. Definitely up there.
Yeah, he's definitely up there, I've studied a lot about relativity and time, and there's a huge part of the book devoted to what time, how time actually works. We probably don't have time to go into that, but anyway, meeting Albert Einstein and talking to him, and I have to tell you, when I wrote these chapters with these famous people, and there were three of them, Carl Jung was the second, and as you mentioned, Martin Luther King Jr. I actually, at the end of these chapters, I was, this is going to sound ridiculous, but I was almost moved as if I had spoken to them. I think for me, they're some of my favorite chapters in the book, and they were just really very personal experiences. I know that sounds bizarre, since I'm making this stuff up as I go along, but you know, I had to obviously learn a lot about each of these characters and review a lot that I already knew, and so I did feel very much like I was having a conversation with them, and each one I talked to for a different reason.
And, you know, you mention in, maybe it's in the King chapter about Tikkun Olam, about, you know, your job is to fix the world and get to the promised land. In the course of creating this book, did you feel that you changed?
Yes. You know, well, let me put it this way. I changed before, having written my other two books, they really changed me. You know, I think it's like when you're a student, If you really want to be able to have a grasp of the material, you have to be able to teach it. Once you start teaching something, right, then you really start to learn it. That's
absolutely
when you really know it. Yeah. And that's what happened to me as I was writing my other two books. And this book, I would say Franklin Rock had so much meaning for me. You know, it's very difficult to describe why, with all I've done in my life, why writing a novel had moved me so much, as you suggested. But it did. It brought a lot of the concepts that I've thought about for many years together. And as I mentioned, it's very optimistic. And I am an optimistic person, but I really believe there's every reason to be optimistic. I think there's a deeper story to the world. I'm telling this to a rabbi, but I do think that there's a deeper story to the world, that the world we see is just a veneer, that there is an overall purpose to life. My second book, which is called The Currency of Life, here's why I wrote it. Art Buchwald, I don't know if you remember him.
Oh, I loved Art Buchwald. Yeah, of course.
Very famous columnist, New York, syndicated around the country. His very last article, a column he wrote from his hospice, and he describes how his friends were coming in to see him and said, "Art, what do you think? Is there a hereafter? Where do we go from here?" And Art looked at him and said, "Look, if you want to believe in a hereafter, it's fine. Whatever makes you happy. But what I really want to know is, what are we doing here in the first place?" And that struck me. And that really was the motivation for me of a lot of the inquiry I've done and the books I've written. What are we here? Why are we here in the first place? And again, I'm talking to a rabbi. I don't need to tell you. But I think that's to me the most important question to ask, because it determines what the purpose of life is. And the purpose of life, once you have a grasp of what you think the purpose of life is, that directs your entire life. If you think the purpose of life is to get rich, well, then the logical conclusion is do anything you can to get rich. Step on people, cheat, lie, steal, whatever. Because if that's the goal, well, that all makes sense. But if there's some other goal, if there's some other purpose to life that has nothing to do with those things, which is what I believe, and I'm sure you believe, then it changes how you approach your life. It literally changes everything. And that's one of the things that Franklin addresses in the book. You know, why are we here? What happens to us? What's this life all about?
You know, there's a charm to this book that, you know, I don't want it to sound like it's too preachy. It's really not. There's a real charm to it. It seems like you had a lot of fun writing it.
I did. I had so much fun. And writing fiction for me, even though I've written short stories before, I have written other fiction, but I had not written a novel before. And I thought, compared to nonfiction, what's this going to be like? And it was 100 times more fun. You know, some people who write novels, I've spoken to some other novelists, and they know right in the beginning where the book is going. They have everything sketched out. They have all the plots. They have all the relationships. For me, I looked at it totally differently. I knew what the book was about, but I had no idea where I was going, even in a single chapter. And that was a lot of fun. I knew what the story had to be, and I knew who Franklin had to be. But it was quite a journey for me also in writing it, because I really didn't know the end point of any particular chapter. And as things came together, it's like putting a jigsaw puzzle together. At first, you put the pieces together, and it doesn't make sense. And you add more pieces, and all of a sudden, the picture becomes obvious. And then filling in the final pieces is actually a pleasure. You know, everybody knows you get to the end of the jigsaw puzzle, the last 20 pieces are fun because you're not beating your head against the wall. You know where everything goes, and that's really how I finally finished Franklin in that way. All the pieces came together.
You know, without giving away anything, there's almost, I don't know how to put this, I guess a kind of messianic tone at the end. He accomplishes something remarkable, essentially impossible so far in human existence. How did you decide that's how it was going to finish?
Well, you have to be careful when you finish a book like this, because you don't want it to be... If you notice the ending, you don't really know when the ending is, right?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Although, I will say also, I as a reader, I've noticed a lot of people can't figure out how to finish their books. A lot of novels just, you know, really good novels somehow don't end up very well.
Well, you know what I think? I think the writers get tired, and they go, "Oh God, I've had enough of this."
Yeah. 300 pages in, 400, sometimes 800 pages. I got to get over this.
So I wrote the last chapter actually at least a month after I finished the book, because I wasn't sure how I wanted it to end, and I didn't want to get tired. I didn't want to get lazy. I didn't want to say, "Okay, you know, it's enough already. Who doesn't need any more of this?" No. It had to come together in a nice, tight package. And so I took a break, and I thought about it, and I let it kind of flow through my mind. Where did I want to go with this? So the last chapter in the epilogue, which is very short, I wrote a month after I finished the book, and I was so glad I did, because I thought the last chapter, that was just a joy to write. And just putting it all together, tying up all the loose ends. And I think, yeah, I think a lot, I agree with you, a lot of authors, I think, just get lazy at the end and they just want to be done with it.
Yeah. And I don't blame them. Tell us a little bit about the difference between writing nonfiction and fiction. You've talked about it a little, but, you know, it's a different experience in some ways.
You know, in nonfiction, you have to, you know, you have to, you know, you should be telling the truth. You shouldn't be making things up. I mean, some people in nonfiction do kind of make things up and they rewrite.
Yes, yes, they do.
But you're not supposed to, right? You're supposed to be accurate in detail. So it's constraining, right? You have to do your research. You have to be methodical. You know, you have to make sure everything works together. You're not inventing things. Where in fiction, you know, it's a free-for-all. Right, so I like to say, you know, the old story of somebody painting themselves into a corner of the room. Don't paint yourself into the corner of the room. It's a metaphor, right? Well, with fiction, it's not a problem, because if you paint yourself into the corner of the room, all you got to do is turn around and draw a door on the wall and step out of it. Right? You can escape. I always say, if you're clever enough, you can get out of any mess you've gotten yourself into in terms of your writing. So it's so liberating. It's so fun. It's, you know, that's why a lot of times I would sit down and write a chapter, and I'd have a vague idea of what I wanted to be, but I really didn't know. And I would start writing, and an hour later, I've written, 100 words, but I would just say, keep going, keep thinking. And all of a sudden, usually because of a character having a conversation with another character, the idea would just become obvious. And then I could see the entire scene in my head at that point, and I'd just write the scene. I mean, it was a blast. It was very easy. It was fun. And then, of course, you know, if you've written, that's the easy part. You know, I tell one of my kids that writing is, you know, just basically vomit on the page to start with, and then you got to clean up the mess, right?
Yeah.
So that's the hard part. So you write and write, rewrite, rewrite, rewrite. You know, 30 iterations later, you have something you like. So, but that's, to me, it's a lot more fun than writing nonfiction.
You know, you talk about fixing the world, repairing the world. Writing's a good lesson in that, because it takes just as much work to repair what you've started, I think. You know, in order to make it good, you have to continually hone and craft.
Yes, you do. It's I think Mark Twain once said, this would have been shorter, but I ran out of time.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, there's a lot of famous.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, right, exactly. You end up. Spend most of your time cutting things out, rewriting, editing, shortening. Things rarely get longer during the editing process. You have to. It is.
Well, and you feel like you've just left parts of your body on the floor or in the delete key. You know, I worked so hard, and it doesn't really work there.
Well, I'll tell you what you think. The prologue I had written a long time ago, and it was long, and literally, I would say on the very last iteration of the book before I submitted it, I looked at the prologue and I cut out 90% of it. I just deleted 90% of it. I said, I don't need it. You know, now that the book is done, I don't need the beginning that I wrote. It's distracting. It doesn't flow. You know, a book has to flow. I like short chapters, and I like books that are easy to read. If a book is tedious, you know, even if it's, quote, great literature, if it's tedious, it's hard to spend the time doing it. So I believe in writing short chapters, short paragraphs, things that are easy to read, and to get that, it's a big cleanup project. You have to work really hard to take what you originally vomited on that page and make sure it flows and it's easy reading and it's pleasant, and the reader just kind of feels like he or she is on a boat just sliding down the river without any obstacles in the way. That's how I like to read, and so that's what I try to do when I write. And I think the book flows nicely, and I think it's an easy read.
It is, but it has something to say. It's really, as I said, it's charming, it's interesting, and I think it'll be valuable for a lot of people. I think it works for a variety of ages, too. Mark, where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about Franklin Rock?
Well, you can go to my website, which is Mark E. Klein, M.D. That's MarkEKLeinMD.com. The book is available pretty much anywhere, Amazon and so on. It's easy to find. The name of the book is Franklin Rock, R-O-C-K, and I hope people read it, mostly because I think I want people to get some of those vegetables and have a have something that they can take with them at the end of the book. For me, reading is great, but I want to have something when I'm done. I don't particularly read a lot of mysteries and so on, because I like to have something when I'm finished, something I can carry with me. And I think I've hopefully done that.
I think you have. Thank you very much for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a Jewish synagogue in the northwest of Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter and now spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson of the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, life cycle ceremonies, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in its own building. Passover is coming up, Pesach, and you have the chance to celebrate a part together by coming to the Rabbi's Seder table, mine, at least virtually. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org for more information coming soon. In fact, for information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of adult education academy courses, and of course Seder, all available on Zoom. Of course, all of our services on Facebook Live. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest growing Jewish congregation and Jewish community in the Northwest and all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Ed Chaim, who rose from a Jewish orphanage to become a financial titan and CEO of a financial services empire, and whose autobiography, On the Road Less Traveled, is fascinating and will be released this coming week. Our playout this morning comes for the upcoming Festival of Pesach, Passover, now exactly 4 weeks away. Don't miss our upcoming A Part Together Seder at the Rabbi's Table programs with me at Congregation Beit Simcha on Facebook Live, a fantastic preview of Pesach coming up soon. This recording is my dad's Passover medley from Rabbi Baruch Kohan and me, B'chol Dor V'Dor and Shalach Ami. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of health and of peace.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.